Evan, I think you're pretty quiet.
Yeah, what happened?
Testing. Yeah, you're pretty distant. Okay. How are you feeling? Just kidding.
I feel fine. Is that okay?
This is the PC Gamer Podcast, episode 171. The date is April 9th, 2009. On today's show, the PC Gamer reveals the new look of Borderlands, Will Wright bails on EA, while you'll be playing Dragon Age through 2011, and more. I'm your host, PC Gamer's Reviews Editor, Dan Stapleton, and with me today are our Previews Editor, Evan Lottie.
Good afternoon.
Our intern, Josh Augustine.
Ahoy.
Our producer, Andy Bauman.
Hello.
And our alumnus, Gary Witta.
Hello there.
I suppose you're all wondering why I've called you here today. One thing I've been noticing in the news was there's been all this talk about piracy and anti-piracy and all that stuff, and all of a sudden actual pirates have come out of the woodwork to take back the term piracy. You see like all the semantic arguments online of people saying it's actually copyright violation or whatever the technical term of it is, and they draw like diagrams of stealing, which is actually removing somebody else's property, copyright infringement, which is making a copy of somebody else's property without removing the original, and then piracy is like Jack Sparrow going "R." Well, they've got the actual pirates are coming out of the woodwork now, and like they've like kidnapped a bunch of Americans and like a freighter captain, so and that's like a big international incident right now. So I kind of wonder if that's going to have any effect on the piracy debate, if anybody's going to stop calling that like actual piracy, saying piracy right now kind of means something else.
I don't think these like insane Somalis with AK-47s are doing this because they go on the Pirate Bay and they're like, oh, these guys are giving us a bad name, we've got to assert ourselves.
I don't think that's their motivation. No,
I don't think that's what's going on. And I think this is, I think in the broader picture of it all, where people are actually kind of in getting killed and living in fear of their lives on the high seas, I don't really know if this is the burning issue, whether or not it's going to change attitudes towards software pirates. But interesting that you brought it up.
I just mean that the term, the terminology, like you say piracy right now, and people are thinking about actual YAR pirates as opposed to software pirates. It's just kind of a confusion of the term, which, it's not a big issue at all. It's just something that occurred to me.
And the thing is, it's not even like YAR pirates anymore. I mean, that's the interesting thing, is there's a big distinction now between what we think of like romantic type, Captain Jack Sparrow type piracy, and the kind of piracy you see in the Atlantic Ocean today, which is not cool. It's just scary. There's no swashbuckling going on. There's just people getting killed.
Strictly speaking, that's what piracy has always been about. I mean, unless you romanticize it, which I mean,
right. But I'm saying that's right. But I'm sure that the true pirates of the Caribbean in like the 17th and 18th centuries and so on were actually quite brutal and scary. And what we've come up with is this Disneyfied version of it. And when we see piracy today, we probably see a much closer analog to what it was like in times of yore. But but to get back to the initial point, like what are you going to do? The word piracy is like spam. It is the terms are ingrained. You're not going to – what would you suggest as an alternate term?
I don't know. Copyright infringement?
It's not sexy though, is it? It does not
have the rank to it.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's kind of an irrelevant question. It's just something I figured just occurred to me.
I'm kind of curious to know what the etymology of the word is. Like, it's the same with spam. I have no idea where the word spam came from in terms of junk email. And I don't know where piracy came from in terms of media – illegal media copying. Who decided that it was that piracy was the word? And when, like you say, it's not really the same thing at all. So why did it get stuck with that moniker? Because it's been around for as long as I remember. Back in the old 8-bit days when people were sending each other, mixtapes of copied 8-bit games on 64 and Spectrum. It was called piracy. So it's been around for a good few decades. I just don't remember how it started.
This looks like a job for Wikipedia. But anyway, so well, I'm sure a bunch of our listeners will look that up on Wikipedia and find that out, or we can do it for next week. But so on to actual gaming news. There's a little bit of a conversation going on that started by the latest PC Gamer issue, the June issue, which should be hitting subscribers right around now, which has Gearbox's Borderlands on the cover. And what's gotten people all kind of excited about it, or you know, at least talking about it, is that they've completely changed the art style of the game from what was seen a year ago. When they announced it, it's an Unreal 3 based game, it's a shooter, and it's you know kind of on a wasteland world with a lot of you know kind of post apocalyptic looking, although there's actually, in this particular case there was no apocalypse, the world was always screwed up, but you know it's all very brown and gray and realistic looking. So Gearbox saw that, you know, saw it kind of getting lost in the crowd, and they figured, okay, we got to do something to make it stand out. So they revamped the art style, and they've made it. It's not cel shaded. They've made that very clear. They don't want it to be called cel shaded. They call it what's concept style, because what they found was they looked at their concept drawings for the game. You know, you always see concept art drawings for games that come out. And they saw the concept drawings. It's like, oh, that looks really cool. And then they saw what they ended up with, and it's you know kind of a realistic thing. And it's like, oh, that looks like everything else. So they decided to make the game actually look like the concept art. And what they did, I think, looks pretty damn cool. Our opening spread of the feature story has a screenshot that at first glance looks kind of like a drawing. You kind of look at it twice. To figure out what's going on there, but they're like reading some comments on some blog posts, you know, talking about the story. A lot of people react kind of negatively to any kind of cel shading or similar art style. Do you guys have any reaction to one way or the other to the term cel shading?
Well, when you first were talking about it, I was a little bit skeptical, but when you mentioned that it's going to look like concept art, that's when I was thinking, oh wow, that reminded me of the time in the Crisis part where you go into the ship and it's all anti-gravity, and that to me was like, man, this looks like probably exactly what the concept art looked like. It was just the way it looked through the like atmosphere that was all muddy and like glowy, and everything had this like really unique look to it, and that was cool to me, and I wish like they had done more with that, because it totally looked like concept art.
Yeah, I guess in Warhead they did go a little bit more that direction, a little bit more exaggerated and stylized color in the color scheme anyway.
Yeah.
But this is you know much more extreme than that. It kind of throws the realism out the window. They exaggerated the character proportions a little bit to be more. It looks like a graphic novel. You know, it doesn't look like a cartoon on TV. It looks like looks like something you'd see in a comic book. So it's more detailed than like television animation would be.
Yeah, I really like cel shaded animation. I think, or the art style. I think it looks really cool. And concept art, I love looking at concept art. I'll buy any of like the upgraded editions of games if it comes with a concept art book. I just love looking at it. So I love this art style in Borderlands. I've been looking at it for a few weeks now. I just get up off my desk and go look at it because I love checking it out.
You'll buy anything with concept art? Wow, you're a sucker.
If it's good concept art, or if the game is actually interesting. But, like, you know, if it's like $10 more or whatever and it comes with a concept art book, I'll definitely buy it.
What about you guys? What do you think about cel-shaded or similar illustrative art styles?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to generalize about. I think, you know, you go with whatever art style is appropriate to the type of game. I actually am I'm a fan of the cel shading style in particular when it's used appropriately. I mean, I remember, you know, Jet Set Radio and some of those early games that used it really well. Although for the most part, I think it kind of, you know, it's got to be used for a kind of a fantasy style world, or if you're going for a comic book look, it's appropriate, because I generally find that it takes you out of the game a little bit. As soon as you kind of start putting those fake lines around everything, you know, you're aware of the fact that what you're looking at on the screen is graphics, and I think it's a little bit harder to be convinced that what you're looking at is real, and to have that suspension of disbelief take you further into the game. So, it's what's appropriate. I haven't seen the different styles on this game yet, so I wouldn't be able to comment on what's most appropriate for this. But if they think it's the right thing, then I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, I don't want to take too much of a marketing perspective, but again, like in this time period of the past few years, and including some upcoming games, we have Fallout 3, Terminator Salvation, Rage. There's one other one I can't remember.
Well, you can even compare it to, you know, Half-Life 2 and Doom 3. Yeah. Those were both
Stalker, I guess, fits in
Stalker,
there.
Stalker, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, you have a very clear sort of precedent for what a post-apocalyptic game looks like, and if you want to give people something fresh and new, that this is a good approach, I guess.
Right. So, I mean, looking at this, you will not mistake it for any other game. So that's a little, it definitely has that advantage. I personally really I'm kind of with Josh on the art style. I think is very eye catching. I think part of the problem with it that it has perceptionally that people do attach some negative connotation to it is that a lot of the games that have used it so far have not been very good. I mean, just recently, look at Merchants of Brooklyn, that has a very very comic booky art style. It looks kind of cool, but the game itself is crap. If you go back to like 13,
yeah, I was going to ask, did anybody play that?
I think I played it for like 10 minutes. I don't think I got very far into it, but it did not, you know, did not make a very big splash. It was kind of forgettable, but it, you know, it looked cool. It was a cool idea. I just don't think it was very well executed. I know there was a Spider-Man, Ultimate Spider-Man game a few years ago that I thought did it pretty well, actually, but again, not a great game. So I mean, it could just be that there hasn't been a really great game that uses that art style to great effect. I guess Prince of Persia, the latest one, also did it. That's a very polarizing game. A lot of people like hate that game. So that probably didn't help it in a lot of people's minds.
That is a conversation I'd like to have sometime. Whether or not fatigue exists for certain art styles, and if they can be overused, if there is such a thing in the consumer's mind.
Well, I mean, realism. I don't know if you can really have realism fatigue, can you? I mean,
just no. But you could have art style. You could have brown and gray apocalyptic fatigue.
Gears of War fatigue.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, setting fatigue, definitely. Sure. I mean, people got sick of World War II because it, you know, there were a bajillion World War II games coming out for a while. Now it's slowed down a bit, and you can appreciate it a little bit more. But when every other game looks, when all the games look exactly the same, then yeah, it does get really boring. But yeah, we encourage you to pick up that issue and take a look at it, because it, you know, definitely a very attractive game and we've got some interesting stuff in there with comparisons of the new versus the old art style that they had a year ago, and also comparisons of the actual concept art with the in-game models that are pretty cool.
Yeah, I like that image that sort of splits the main character down the middle, and one side is the concept art and the other side is the real art, and it's actually very difficult to tell which is which.
Yeah, I mean, when you really take a look at it, like some of the lines on the concept art aren't like closed, so you know it's kind of a little bit looser art style. So, but they kind of have to do that with the way the rendering works. It has to have a complete outline. But it takes a couple of seconds to figure out which is which, which is a real achievement. I mean, to match up an art style that closely. The other big news that came out just yesterday was that Will Wright, arguably like the most famous game designer in history, has decided to leave Electronic Arts and Maxis to start a company called, is it Stupid Fun Entertainment?
Yeah,
it's a really kind of goofy name place, but it's being billed as a think tank where they come up with new IPs and, you know, new license, you know, franchises or whatever you want to call it, like a new universe, new characters, new story around which games, movies, TV shows, books, whatever will be. I guess he's taking like maybe what he's, I don't know if it's what he's best at, but maybe what he's most interested in at this point, and making it his entire job rather than spreading his time over the whole development cycle. So
I'd say there's an unfortunate trend developing here, coming out of the Game Developers Conference. We hosted that Luminaries Lunch thing a year ago. This inaugural thing that David Perry put together, where we had a bunch of well-known game developers sit around and talk about the industry, and I was the moderator for it. And right after we did it, two of the guys that we had there, Phil Harrison and Neil Young, both left their jobs. Neil left EA, and Sony left. Phil left Sony and went to work for Infogrames. Right. And so there was a little bit of a worry that there might be a curse developing. We thought, oh well, nothing will happen this year. And we looked at all the people that were coming this year, and Will was among them. And you know, he'd been with EA for many years. I'm like, oh well, we don't have to worry about any of these guys. And of course, right after he comes and does our panel, he quits EA. So I'm a little worried there might be a bit of a curse developing here.
Yeah, stop hosting that immediately. But but you know, he's not leaving games entirely. You know, he's still going to be coming up with concepts for games, and you know, that's arguably what he's best at. What his main contribution is. I have to wonder if that has something to do with frustration over some of the things that EA is. That some of the ways that EA has handled things like Spore. I remember reading that I think it was on a Kotaku story where there were kind of divergent paths on Spore, where his vision was a more realistic evolution simulation, and then they kind of diverged from that and made it more kind of cartoony and overly friendly.
I think there's got to be some frustration with regard to Spore. If you go back about a year when the game was first about to come out. Will was really kind of on top of the world. You know, he was doing his own, kind of keynote seminars at GDC, and everyone was very, very excited about Spore. It was definitely, you know, one of the top games, the most anticipated game of the year. And then, you know, and EA had basically built almost a complete department at EA around it. You know, the idea of creating a label around, a publishing label around Spore, the way that they've created a whole cottage industry out of the Sims games, all these different expansions and spin-offs. And obviously the game hasn't had anything like the success that The Sims has had. It's been successful, but I don't think it did not blow up the way they wanted it to a Sims-type level. And I wonder if there is some frustration on Will's part about how EA handled the marketing, or if they mismanaged it in some way, or if he's just kind of bummed in general that he's had his first big title after The Sims that didn't replicate that success, if he's just kind of bummed overall, if he's disappointed in himself or he's disappointed in EA, I guess it could lead you to kind of want to step back and reevaluate, but who knows?
Or maybe he's just had enough. You know, he's been doing this a long time, so you know that might make somebody want to branch off into something else.
I mean, clearly financially, if he doesn't want to, he never has to work another day in his life. I mean, and that's compelling if you want to go sit on a beach. But I don't think people like Will. Are able to do that. I think they have the kind of mind that drove them to be a success in the first place. Continue to be the kind of minds that won't let them just go sit on a beach. I remember years ago, Peter Molyneux did that. He sold Bullfrog to Electronic Arts and made millions and millions. And he basically kind of went into semi-retirement and couldn't do it. Couldn't just sit around doing nothing. He had to, continue to satisfy his muse to create stuff. And so, kind of got back into the business with Lionhead and is still going to this day. So I think, you can take a break, you can step back and, take a step away from the daily stresses and pressures of game development and meeting public expectations. I mean, it must be nice to take a week or a month or even a year off and say, I don't have to worry about any of that stuff. But eventually he's going to get back to creating something, whether it be games or something else. I think he's always going to be in the business of creating stuff, because I think creative minds are as potent as Will's, cannot sit at rest. They have to do things.
Yeah, in this case, he's gone like kind of the other direction from taking a break. He's gone like into the intense, like all he's doing is creating. So maybe he's feeling too creative for game development. So, like I said, and EA, I guess, is one of the co-owners of this new company. Will Wright is a co-owner, EA is a co-owner, and there's a third, like, silent partner that's a lesser investor. So I'm sure that some of his ideas will end up in EA games in the future.
I wonder if they'll say, like, out of the stupid fun club comes, like, this title. I wonder if they'll mention
I'm sure they will.
Because now it has, like, super, like, cred, you know?
Well, you know, it'll have super cred once it actually does something.
Well, sure. Well, now that Wright is, like, officially with it, like 100%.
I mean, it's got his name behind it.
Yeah.
But until it actually does something, I'd say the actual cred will come when it does a major product that's cool. We'll have to wait and see what exactly that that and there's certainly a lot of anticipation around it. Also out of EA, there's an announcement that Dragon Age, which is due to launch this year, they'll be producing extra downloadable content for it for 2 full years after it launches, which presumably, since Dragon Age is supposed to be a trilogy, will presumably be the duration between the first game and the second game. And that's I think, one of the more structured, ambitious DLC plans that we've heard so far.
It's like Rock Band.
Yeah. Although, I mean, has Rock Band even made like bold claims, like we're going to be doing this 24 months from now?
I don't know.
They've been doing it every week, at least, or about every week, I think. I mean, the difference here is, I mean, can a fantasy role-playing single-player game really introduce that kind of modular content over and over again? I know
that's compelling. It can, but it won't be compelling. Well
yeah, exactly. Maybe. Like, are they going to do new towns, new characters, new weapons? Like, I just don't see it as that kind of, it's not conducive to that kind of experience and that kind of content, you know?
Well, it depends on what kind of content, and we don't know exactly what kind of content they're going to be doing so far. So it could be that almost certainly they've designed the game with this in mind. So they would have built ways to do that. And I'm sure, you know, BioWare doesn't like sit around and do the same thing over and over again. They think about stuff a lot. I mean, these are some pretty smart guys. So I'm sure they've got some kind of plan. Whether or not that will be successful, we'll have to wait and see. But they've got to have some kind of plan to set themselves apart a little bit. I mean, you look at what they're talking about with the Old Republic. And they've got you know the idea of the story based stuff, and they've got the idea of the companion characters that set it apart from other MMOs. So I'm sure they're not just going to crank out the same kind of DLC that everybody else is going to do.
I'm just a little skeptical after. I mean, Mass Effect has had one piece of DLC that was really insignificant, and I remember them saying that they were going to do more of that and didn't really pan out, and they're just, I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm just really fond of sort of the history and the precedent that, you know, big expansion packs did for games like Oblivion, and well, Oblivion's maybe not the best example, but just fantasy games like Baldur's Gate and whatnot, so we'll see. Hopefully it's bundled nicely and not too micro, I guess.
It is true that the Mass Effect DRM didn't make that much of a splash. That's a good point. But hopefully they've learned something from that. I keep talking to a lot of developers that want to make DLC just a big part of their strategy. So mm-hmm. like part, a lot of what they're doing now is they're talking to the publisher in advance, saying, you know, this is a roadmap, and we want to have this funded up front. Have this be part of the budget. So, like, immediately after the game, or even before the game is completely finished, they'll start working on extra stuff that will, you know, extra DLC. So it's not even like wait and see how well the game does. They're already working on it. It's part of the budget. So, it's becoming more and more part of their business plan.
You've also got to figure out like how you break down the DLC and just the regular sequels. I mean, as well. I mean, Mass Effect 2 is now not that far away, right? So.
Right.
At some point, you've got to decide, you know, that you're done with the DLC for this game, and now you're on to the next game. It's interesting to see an approach like Valve, where they've kind of gone almost entirely in favor of the DLC, where they're basically kind of foregoing Half-Life 3, it would appear, you know, for the time being. I mean, I'm sure there's someone there working on it, but, you know, right now they're more interested in continuing the episodes, and we're waiting a lot longer for the real Half-Life 3, because we're, you know, perfectly happy to be occupied by the Half-Life 2 episodes. So that's a decision that they've made, where you've got a situation like BioWare, where they're doing a more conventional model of, like, you know, a couple of years between sequels. There's only really so much DLC they can then cram in, you know, between those cycles.
I don't know if that's exactly accurate. They're concentrating more on the on the episodes and on Half-Life 3. I mean, they've got to be working on it behind closed doors.
No, I don't mean to suggest that it's not something they're seriously think. I'm sure they have like a whole department there that's like cranking stuff out, and it's coming along. I'm just saying that had they not put so much effort into playing out the Half-Life 2 episodes, we probably would be looking at, we probably have Half-Life 3 by now, or it would be much closer than it is. But they've put the full games on a much longer cycle because they're happy to play out the DLC to its fullest extent in between the, you know, the full iterations of the new games.
I don't know, how long was it between Half-Life 1 and Half-Life 2? It was came out in what, 04? And Half-Life 1 was 98? Yeah, so
6 years.
Yeah, so they've got a little
right. And now we're looking at 11 years. between Half-Life 2 and Half-Life 3, and there's still no sign of Half-Life 3. We still don't know when it's coming, so it could still be more years away.
I keep
clearly it's a much longer cycle at Valve.
Absolutely. I mean, is Episode 3 relevant if it comes out in 2010? Like, there's been such a long layover on that story at this point, and the cliffhanger that it left us with. That, I mean, how much would it mean to us? I mean, maybe I'm being too skeptical, but I feel like it needs to come out this year just to refresh.
Yeah, it's definitely an experimental model, and I guess it remains to be seen how well it's going to work, because Valve are really the only guys that are doing it the way that no one else is doing what they're doing, and it's you're waiting almost the length of time that you might wait for a completely new sequel, but what you're getting is this kind of piecemeal thing. I mean, I remember when Episode 2 came out, nobody complained, everyone was really happy to get it, and there was certainly enough there to satisfy people. But you remember what they also did was they packaged it in as part of the Orange Box. So it was, it still felt like there was a lot of value there. You didn't just get Half-Life Episode 2. You got Team Fortress, you got Portal, you got all this great stuff. I wonder if they have anything in place for, maybe they've got other secret stuff that when Episode 3 comes out, there's a lemon box, who knows? There's a bunch of other cool stuff in it.
Yeah, I'm sure that since that strategy worked so well for them, I'd be surprised if they didn't do that again. They'll have to package it maybe with, a Portal 2 or some other Left 4 Dead style thing that they pluck out of out of development that has promise, and they bring it in house and polish it. But look how
great they've been though with supporting their other games. I think they really are the standard bearers for DLC when you look at, for example, Team Fortress 2.
Oh, they've
continued to support that really well, not just with new maps, but with constantly evolving the gameplay with the different abilities and weapons for each of the classes, the new videos. That Team Fortress 2 has been around a while now, but they continue to keep people interested in it because they're always refreshing it and always putting a new lick of paint or a new feature or all the character videos still aren't out yet. You got to remember they're really kind of pacing themselves, and they're keeping people interested.
And the Left 4 Dead expansion or the DLC is coming out. When is that? A couple weeks, Evan?
21st, so 2 weeks from last Tuesday, I think.
Yeah, so coming up soon.
Days. Yeah, and again, Gary, just to hit on that a little bit more, that idea of not releasing a static product and having it be a platform for development, right? It's not even really a game. It's a platform for content and not even necessarily DLC. I mean, in Team Fortress 2, I talked to a lot of players that are really upset by some of the updates and say they unbalance the game or they change the way the game feels. I mean, the best example I can give is probably from a smaller update when they updated the engineer's ability to upgrade his teleporters and his dispensers to basically be more efficient, and they gave the spy the ability to change what weapon and a purity he was holding. So essentially, as players had gotten used to seeing spies, they would get used to knowing what weapon he had and sort of based on that expectation they could sort of judge what a character was, if he was a spy or not. So it's just that idea of as their player base's experience grows in the game, they should grow with it and sort of move parallel with it. And it's just a great approach, I think, and it's working out really well.
Yeah, I mean, letting the argument that's a bad thing, that they have to find a new way to find spies ruins the game. That's weird. I mean that's keeping them on their toes. That's not letting them be complacent and just not doing anything, not thinking.
It's a very risky thing that they do with Team Fortress. If you add a new map and the map's not very good, well, that's fine. People don't play it; they'll just stick with the other maps. It's kind of a bummer, but you haven't broken the game. Any time that they add one of these new abilities or a new feature to a character, they're making a potentially game-changing move. It hopefully will make the game better, but if people don't like it or there's something they didn't foresee, they can break the whole game or make the game worse, and then they've got to go in and fix that. It's kind of the same issue that, MMO makers have when they're constantly tweaking and nerfing characters and trying to improve the balance. But, a lot of times they get grief from the player base for making something worse. And in a class-based game, you can never really win, because any time you make a change to a particular class, all the people that play that class, predominantly probably hate it because they're going to see it as a nerf no matter what you do. And all the players who hate those classes are probably going to see it the other way. Oh, you made that class too powerful. Like, it's just constant grief. I imagine at Valve that the only way that they can function is if they just stay off the internet.
right?
because it's generally not a very grateful player base, the guys on the internet. They're usually just looking for reasons to complain. So it's a high risk business what they do in constantly trying to inch the game up, further up the bar, making it a little bit better and a little bit better. Every time they make one of these tweaks, you know, they run the risk that the whole house of cards is gonna come collapsing down. So I give them credit for that.
Yeah, can you imagine like having to sort through the community feedback? I mean, just go to any game forum, like official forum, and read the comments and look at how many of these things that people are suggesting are just horrible, horribly bad ideas that would ruin everything. and you know, the people that are just howling over every little change. It's got to be soul crushing. I don't know how they do it.
But, yeah, I mean they have people whose job it is to do nothing but that, because you know, you don't want to go anywhere near it yourself. I hope they give those guys plenty of money, because whatever they earn, yeah, it's not enough.
But Evan, was you read that that Dragon Age DLC story a little more closely than I did. Was there anything else significant in there that we should discuss?
I mean, it was pretty vague stuff. They didn't say what the DLC itself would be. But Greg, he at least made the statement that they have a very strong philosophy. It's got to be valuable with respect to the DLC. So I guess their general philosophy is that it's not going to be horse armor. It's not going to be micro stuff. I hope I'm interpreting that correctly. I don't know if they go as far to, I mean, if you read our cover story, you know, Dragon Age sort of based on having six origins and sort of choose one of those roles and go through the game differently, encounter different characters. I don't know if they go as far as to introduce a new origin. That'd be really ambitious and probably a lot of content, but I'm sure there's at least a couple they scrapped or they cut from the original game that they might look to reintroduce. So
with a game like that, with an RPG, I mean, you've got to have something, a single player RPG anyway, in particular. If you got to have something that is compelling enough to bring people back to the game after they've already finished it, you know. So, and especially if it's something that can't be done like at any player level. I mean, Fallout has done a pretty good job of that, where they've allowed you to do it at pretty much any point in the game. You know, the two DLC packs that have come out. You can play with a new character or a character that you've been playing for, you know, 50 hours, but if it's just something like horse armor, it's like you wouldn't go back to a game just for horse armor.
No, I totally get what you're saying. I mean, somehow it's got to be stuff that works, because I mean, if Dragon Age is sort of a traditional experience where you have a beginning and an end, and you can't continue to play the game and do side quests after you end, I'm not sure if that's going to be the case. How is that going to be integrated? Do you have to go back to a former save point? I'm not sure. We'll see.
Right. Alternatively, it could be a separate, self-contained little module, but it'll remain to be seen when they talk more about it.
I guess I should probably also mention the announcement yesterday that BioWare is accepting testers for its Dragon Age toolset, which is actually really exciting. It's not an open beta test, but they're accepting applications for the closed beta. And if you want to check that out, head on over to dragonage.bioware.com/builder-beta.
So that's mod tools, right? That's not...
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So that won't be very interesting to the vast, vast, vast majority of you. But the few of you out there who are accomplished modders and actually know your way in and out of these kind of things might get some interest out of that.
It's actually a pretty robust set of tools from what they showed me before. There's a cutscene editor. There's a quest tree editor. You can put in your own dialogue for different quest decisions. You can equip enemies with specific armor and weapons and place them and things like that.
It's still not something. It's still not something that the casual user is going to be able to get into. It's something that you have to have, you know, a pretty technical dedication to really appreciate and really make something more than like a room with a guy with a sword in it.
Well, you can use all of their preset stuff in their environments. It's actually a pretty comfortable interface from what they showed me before. And, I mean, the best news about their toolset stuff on PC, I mean, again, with, like, the good history that Neverwinter Nights had in content creation, instead of crawling, you know, different websites and message boards that are dedicated to that mod, it's going to be integrated into the game and you're going to be able to pull user-generated content through the menus. That's what they told me, at least, instead of, you know, going online and searching for it and looking through all these crazy community websites. So that's the best news, I think.
As long as they have a way for players to, like, rate the content, because that's why I like the websites, because you can just go to their top 10 list or something and just grab the best 10.
Right. I mean, there are so many bad mods out there. I mean, like, people will upload their guy in a room with a sword that you know you'll have to sort through and pick out just the good ones is a pain in the ass. So hopefully there will be some kind of rating system. I can't imagine they would put something up there without some kind of recommendation system. There's a new game online now called Close Range, in which you shoot. It's a flash game in which you shoot people in the face. That's all you do. It was made by The Onion for a story they did, you know, parodying like big console game launches that are seen by, you know, people who are not gamers as you know murder simulators or whatever. When I guess, you know, parents or people that are not into gaming see a game like Halo or Gears of War, It looks like all it is shooting people in the face. So they did this parody video about a game that is exactly that. And you can actually go and play the Flash version of this game where you shoot people in the face just over and over again. It's pretty hilarious, actually. I recommend watching the video they did of it.
Yeah, it's awesome that they actually commissioned. I mean, there's footage of the game being played in the video that they did, and it's actually. Probably took a little while to create all that. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, they've got actual, you know, models of faces that you shoot, and they kind of explode in a shower of gore and fall down, and then a new face pops up, and you shoot that. Yeah, and they also have side missions in which you shoot ostriches and
and horses.
And horses.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if it's you can call it one of the more intelligent pieces of gaming parody I've seen, but it's certainly very funny. I mean, it's intelligent in, I guess, it's a parody of the media, mainstream media coverage of video games, not games themselves. So I got a good laugh out of it. So speaking of mainstream media and games, the Nielsen company, which, you know, they do all the ratings of you know, how well TV shows are doing, and I don't think they track movies, but they have recently started tracking games, and they've put out a report saying that the biggest group of PC gamers are women over 25, which, you know, sounds a little bit wacky until you consider that they're counting people playing solitaire or Minesweeper. You know, it's not really the definition of PC gamer that you know we would have. They're counting all of the games that come on every copy of Windows. But besides which, I personally don't trust Nielsen all that much, because I've never been a Nielsen tester. I don't know anyone who's ever been a Nielsen tester. I don't know who these people are. How they're selecting it. You know, whether the people. It's just such a weird methodology they use.
You can't keep looking down on these people, though, Dan. These people are the future of gaming, the casual gaming. That's where it's at now. You gotta get on board or get out of the way.
I'm all in favor of it. It's just when they talk about, you know, their definition of a PC gamer is a little bit different from you know, everybody else. I mean, they're counting people who are not buying any software for their computer, any game software. They don't think of themselves as gamers. They're just trying to kill some time, so they'll fire up, you know, Hearts or pinball or whatever. And it's just not the same. You know, when they say that PC gamers are this group, it rings as false to me, because it's not what I think of as a PC gamer.
It'd be a little different if those people were, for example, logging on to Yahoo Games or Pogo and playing like multiplayer backgammon. Even that's a little bit of a distinction, but. Playing the stock games that are given to you on Windows is just, yeah, like you said, killing time. It's
yeah. This is a measure of the people that are wasting time at work. It's not really the measure of
and they
PC
are
games.
Women over 25. Damn them.
that's just the largest chunk of them. There's also, yes, you know, plenty of men playing solitaire and free cell.
Yeah, but, I mean, these are the people that the industry can't make money off of, because these are the people that don't buy video games. I mean, on the female side, I think World of Warcraft is the only one that doesn't come on the computer. I don't know what Pictureka Museum Mayhem is, but other than that, I mean, there's only two games that these women are buying. I don't see how the information is useful at all.
Right, and World of Warcraft, on their numbers, they're claiming 430,000 unique World of Warcraft female World of Warcraft players in the United States, which I don't know. I think that's probably a good ballpark number. I know a lot of female WoW players, but they claim there's only 1.2 million male World of Warcraft players, which may be a little bit low.
I actually looked. I just did a quick Google search, and I found in 2007 and 2008, everyone was throwing around 2.5 million North American subscribers. And I mean, it has to have only gotten bigger since then.
Well, not necessarily a whole lot bigger. Well, I mean, maybe
It's risen 4 million total, because it was 8 million back then, and now it's 12 million.
Right, it's always launching in new countries, though, so yeah. They're not necessarily in the U.S. But yeah, I would be surprised if it's any less than 2 million players in the U.S. But yeah, does anybody know anybody who's ever been a Nielsen tester?
One of my best friends had a box for TV, yeah, in Michigan.
Yeah, okay.
It always amazes me how that system works, that they can put boxes in just a very, very small fraction of households. And are able, apparently, to extrapolate fairly accurate data about what the entire nation is watching. I always found that... I've had a hard time believing it, that it's really a representative sample, but the entire TV industry believes it, so I guess there's got to be something to it.
I don't know if that's necessarily true, that there's something to it just because they believe it. I mean, entire industries are built around pretty stupid ideas in my experience that I've seen, so... Somehow they just gained a reputation as being very trustworthy.
Yeah. It does seem hard to believe, but I mean, there's no really better way to do it. So, you kind of have to believe it.
There is, though. I mean, but most of those metrics are not public. I mean, World of Warcraft, they know exactly who's playing and Blizzard knows exactly what their metrics are. With DirecTV and TiVo and Comcast On Demand and all those things, they know exactly what's being watched, but they just don't want to share that information. So, this is I guess the best thing that they have that's public information.
Yeah.
So it used to be that this was the best way to do it. It's not anymore because everything is connected now. I hope that this kind of guesswork goes away because the sample size, it may not be statistically significant. It may not be a really good sample of the people that are actually playing or watching or whatever. There's just so many things that can go wrong with this kind of thing. I could be wrong. It could be completely accurate. Who knows? So other bits of news today. Company of Heroes, Tales of Valor is now out. You can get it off Steam. You can get it off Impulse. You can get it off the store shelves. I heartily recommend it because I'm a big fan of Company of Heroes. However, if you have not played any Company of Heroes in the past, I definitely recommend starting out with just the vanilla version of Company of Heroes because the campaign in there is just incredibly excellent. It's a great place to start playing, even though no campaign is really going to get you ready for multiplayer. That campaign is definitely worth playing. It's just so well produced. It's one of the best production quality RTSs I've ever seen. One of my favorite RTSs of all time.
Somebody's trying to get their quote in the back of a box.
I think my quote probably already is on the back of that box. I endorse that wholeheartedly. You can get it for $20 now off of Steam, so it's a steal at that price. The new expansion, the Tales of Valor, is $30. I don't recommend it quite as heartily because, first of all, the campaigns, I was a little bit disappointed by two or three of them. They're a little bit too easy. It feels like you're on God mode most of the time. It's just kind of and they're very short. They're only 9 missions total, spread over 3 campaigns, and the new multiplayer modes are very cool. They totally changed all the rules. If you heard us talking about them last week with the producer and designer, they've got some very cool ideas. They're really neat once you get the hang of them. The problem is there's only one map each, so they're probably waiting to see which one gets played most so they can design more maps for it. Relic has a pretty good track record of putting out new maps and stuff, but who wants to wait for it? So, yeah, if you're a big Company of Heroes fan already, Tales of Valor is great. If not, start with Company of Heroes. So that's a mini review for you. is anyone else a big Company of Heroes fan? Have you guys played it?
I tried to play. I found it too hard.
Really?
But then everything seems too hard to me these days.
And it is a very tactical RTS. It's
very stressful, yeah. I played it when it came out, and I was just the whole time feeling like after every mission I had to stop playing because I was just like freaking out.
Yeah, and it's you're generally controlling a smaller number of units than the typical RTS. Placement is very important because it's all cover based, and using the right weapon against the right target is very important. So it does take a very intense tactical management, but on the you can turn down the difficulty. It's not that hard a game. It just takes a little getting used to. You should give another shot, actually, if you have some time to kill. It's a great game. So also next week, Demigod comes out. It went gold, I think, 2 days ago. I'm getting my copy tomorrow. I'm very, very excited about that. It's that one for anybody who isn't familiar is from Gas Powered Games. It's based on the Supreme Commander engine, but it's fantasy, and it's multiplayer oriented. It's in the vein of Defense of the Ancients, where you've got a single primary unit that you're controlling, kind of action RPG style, and leveling up and becoming more powerful. And there are a bunch of NPC characters that are fighting on both sides, streaming towards the center of the map. It's your job to push the battle, in the other direction. And you've got other players trying to push it back your direction. So it's a very cool game. Looking forward to playing it. And finally, Crisis Wars, the multiplayer component of Crisis, is now free to play through April 17th. So if you can download that off of Steam, or I think there are a couple other sources to get it. I'm sure if you go to the Crisis website, they'll tell you how to get it. You can play that for free until April 17th. Now, Evan, you haven't played that much at all, have you? You were saying you hadn't given it much of a try.
I really haven't. I didn't finish Warhead for one thing, but no. Right.
But I mean, like with a free multiplayer shooter like this, what would it take to pry you away from Team Fortress 2 and Left 4 Dead long enough to give it a try?
All I would need is some other people to do it. Team Fortress and Left 4 Dead are basically social experiences for me at this point. I'm not playing as much for the shooter mechanics as I am to reunite with people every night and just talk while we're playing and. So, need some friends, basically.
I'm sure you could rally a bunch of others to the cause and jump in there and see how you like it. I've played it, especially when we were doing the reviews of both games. I jumped in with the group to play, and it's a very well built multiplayer game. It's initially like the multiplayer component of Crisis before they put out Crisis Wars along with Warhead was a little bit too involved, like the rules of the game were a little bit too tricky, not intuitive enough, I guess. Like you would have to capture a bunch of points in order to unlock vehicles, and it was never all that clear which ones you needed to capture, But Crisis Wars, they simplified it a bit, so definitely worth a shot, especially for free. All right, with that, let's move on to some Q&A.
Gentlemen, this is Sea Monkey Doo in Ohio. I just wanted to say thanks for having Stan on a couple weeks back. I thought what he had to say about competitive gaming was really pretty interesting. This is something I've been thinking about a lot lately. I'm a librarian, involved in a variety of gaming projects at work. Gaming is a hot topic in library land these days. More and more librarians are seeing its value as a valid form of entertainment, but most get into consoles because they see it as easier. The thing is, libraries are already sitting on great setups for PC gaming. Even small libraries usually have several computers, often more, and a fast internet connection. At my library, we got a great deal on licenses from Valve, and currently we run monthly TF2 and Left 4 Dead parties on our standard-issue Dells. The frame rates aren't what I get at home, but the games are definitely playable. So I want to put this out there. I'm hoping to start a library gaming league. If you work at a library, hang out at a library, or know anyone who does, do your part to talk up the PC. It's cheaper for libraries, and also a lot more fun to have parties that involve more than the four people or whatever consoles can accommodate. The competition's not on par with what Stan's doing. Most of our players don't even own the game, and many don't even have computers at home. But we do have a lot of fun, and people can join in from home as well. So if you know a library, a school, or any other kind of non-profit educational facility like that, we'd love some opponents. You'll probably lose, but we'll have a lot of fun beating you. You can contact us via our Steam group. It's just Twinsburg. Or look up the Twinsburg Public Library in Ohio online. Oh, and just so this is technically a question, Logan, have you rethought your idea from a couple years back about escaping zombies using a man-sized hamster ball? I think that given the lessons of Left 4 Dead, such a device would clearly be vulnerable to strong zombies like the tanks, or those with sharp appendages like a witch or a hunter. Thanks. Keep up the good work.
Thanks. Logan's not on right now, but I think we can field that question. I think a strong enough hamster ball would simply, if a tank hit it, would simply launch you free of danger.
There's something I want to say about Logan, since the subject of him.
Since this cannot end well.
But since we were talking about Logan and rodents, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to just confirm his rodent related credentials for anyone who may doubt that his insane love of an obsession with squirrels and such like and other kind of little woodland creatures is just a fake thing that he puts on. I can assure you it's not. I actually bumped into him recently at Greg Wiedemann's wedding, and there was a bunch of the former PC Gamer EICs and staff members there. Dan, you were there as well, and I showed Logan some pictures that my girlfriend and I had taken a few days ago. We had gone to Golden Gate Park and fed the squirrels, and he was fascinated that there was a place you could go and squirrels were in abundance and you could feed them. And I still wasn't quite sure if he was just putting on an act as like Logan the squirrel guy. But then the very next day, on his Facebook, he had a bunch of pictures taken in the exact same spot that I had told him where we had gone to feeding squirrels. So he had gone out the very next day with a big bag of nuts to where I had directed him to and fed the squirrels and put the pictures on his Facebook. So for anyone who doubts or anyone who cares about Logan's obsession with squirrels, I'm happy to confirm that it is a real thing and not just something he puts on for the benefit of his podcast audience.
If it's an act, he's a method actor.
Oh yeah, I mean, if he's making this up, he's really throwing himself into the part.
but yeah, that was kind of interesting. There were five former PC Gamer editors in chief at that wedding.
Was it Kristen who figured that out? And we had our pictures taken. It was myself, Dan Morris, Kristen Salvatore, Greg Wiedemann, and Rob Smith. Five PC Gamer editors in sequence. No gaps in between. That was an unbroken chain. Of PC Gamer editors. It's quite impressive.
But we should probably think about that actual question that was asked. Well, I guess we adjust the question part of it. But
I didn't know that libraries still existed. Do they still have those?
They do. But
I'd love to play some of those transients who hang out at the Salt Lake Library. I'd love to play some of them in TF2. Show them what's up.
The Kindle has.
I feel like going to the library these days would be kind of like it'd be the same experience as like going to like Colonial Williamsburg or something. This is how people used to do things.
Well, what I think is going to be great for situations like that, because the library in the town where I grew up had they had like some not fancy computers, you know, they're just kind of low end computers that are there for you know people who don't own computers to check their email or whatever, or browse the web for research, making the rest of the reference book completely obsolete. But what will be exciting for those, or at least you know, for a gaming perspective, is things like Quake Live, because you don't need a powerful GPU for that. You can just go and log in and play, and you could essentially have a LAN game there, although it's not actually a LAN game, which would be pretty cool, I think.
It would be a lot of fun. I mean, especially I used to hang out in a lot of net cafes when I was in junior high, I guess. And I mean, they're pretty much non-existent these days. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Internet cafes? No, there's still several of those around. I mean, I guess they've been largely supplanted by like actual cafes that just have internet access and you bring your laptop. But
sure.
But there are a few around still. I think one of the problems that setups like this can run into is or some of the resistance that you might find trying to set up a gaming league at your local public library is people worried about violent video games. You know, you always run into those people. So yeah, if there are no age restrictions on the, you know, if you don't have like any kind of check on the age of the players, you're going to run into a situation where you might want to play an M-rated game. Then, you know, parents might be upset and they throw a fit and the library has to shut you down. So that's something to watch out for.
That's what permission slips are for.
Those work for schools. I don't know if they work for little gaming leagues. But it's worth a try, certainly. All right, let's take another question.
Okay.
Hey, this is AmunRa13 from Spamtown, USA, home of the Hormel Institute for Cancer Research. Thank you guys for pointing out GooseX and SwapTree to trade my old PC games. Now, every day is like my birthday. My question is, do you think a combination of sharing sites and digital distribution will one day prove that the DRM is no longer viable, but just a nuisance?
Every day is like your birthday. You must be aging really fast.
Zing.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I don't know if online distribution is going to. I mean, our online distribution is going to increase the use of DRM because you know, it's tied to your Steam account or Impulse account or whatever.
I think it's one of the reasons why software companies will be happy to move to an online distribution model entirely in the coming years, where they can control every aspect of the experience, from you know, not just playing it, but how it's distributed to you and how much you own it, and how they continue to exert control over you even after you've quote unquote bought the game. There's I think a little bit of a war going on between the publishers and the retail segment of the industry. You know, increasingly the retail business is making a lot of money out of reselling used games. You know, Amazon just got in on the act. They just added a whole new used game trading system where you can send them your old games. They'll send you the box. It's all prepaid, and you know they'll give you a certain amount of money. That's basically what GameStop would give you, and then you can get your new game from Amazon. The problem is the industry doesn't like it because they would much rather you continue to play new games than old ones.
I'm not sure if these distribution methods, the gray market, in other words, will eliminate DRM completely. We are seeing, I mean, Stardock announced something interesting at GDC. I guess they're calling it Goo. I don't know how to introduce that. Logan's putting an article together on it, but it basically allows you to resell your...
Well, okay, what is that a way of putting it? It's not really reselling, because what happens in this particular case is you sell your license for a Stardock or a game purchased off of Impulse. You sell it back to Stardock, and then they turn around and resell it used, which is kind of interesting because there is no difference
physical
between a used and an unused license. So it's remains to be seen how that's going to work out when it actually starts happening. But at least it lets you get, like, if you don't want your game anymore and you want a little bit of money back for it, you can sell it back to Stardock.
And they essentially like repackage the EXE with a certain encryption or something that allows you to redistribute it to somebody.
The Goo thing is it's DRM that's supposed to appease publishers. Now that doesn't have that much to do with the actual reselling of it back. They just got a system in place to accommodate that.
I was saying to Logan yesterday that in order to make it more authentic, they should just sort of scuff up the code a little bit, and if there's a PDF manual, they should bend the edges or pull out the edge or something.
Right.
Yeah, totally.
Logan has IM'd me to tell me to correct that he doesn't think you're really selling it back to Stardock, but to the publisher that you bought it from.
Okay.
So he's done more research on it than I have, so I will defer to him.
In certain cases, Stardock would be the publisher.
In certain cases, yes.
Indeed.
Hi, this is Nelson the Burglar from Maryland, and I have a question about tactical sea battle games. In these troubled times, I've had an interest in playing some sort of tactical sea battle with an easygoing but can be difficult game, maybe one, more ships. I might possibly want to go online, and I'm interested if you guys would be kind enough to talk about a few games that sound interesting. You guys are awesome. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Let's see. I guess the most recent one for that would be Empire Total War has the naval simulations, if you're into the old-timey versions. If not... Battle Stations Midway is already out. Pacific is coming out soon. Those aren't quite as tactical because they do build in, you know, it's built around like a third-person control thing, a control scheme where you're controlling one unit, and then you can go out to map view and order around several other units, or you know, some scenarios are just one unit at a time. You know, that might be what you're after.
Yeah, Battle Stations, I mean, it's strategic in the sense that you are commanding, you know, carriers and ships and even aircraft and submarines. But there is sort of an action role you can take into it in that you can command any of the ship's specific guns, you can command a specific fighter, you know, fire specific torpedoes and whatnot. So it's sort of that mix of, it's not simulation, in other words, it's more accessible. And it will ships to stores on May 12th.
Hi, my name is Mitch from Ohio. discussion about N-War's voice recognition reminded me of a really crappy 1996 game called The Adventures of Pinocchio. The game was a four-disc FMV adventure, which you could play with a mouse or a microphone. The idea was for kids too young to know how to use a mouse could simply answer the game's basic yes, no, right, or left questions with a verbal response. My friends and I played the game only for the novelty of voice input, but once that wore off, we basically started responding with nonsense, like, you know, fart sounds or whatever a 12-year-old would say. What made it funny was the game always took it as a serious answer. So, anyways, my question is, have you guys ever had a bad experience with voice recognition and out of boredom started to mess with it? Thanks for taking my question.
Let's see, the only other really, like, voice-controlled game I ever at least tried to use was Bridge Commander, Star Trek Bridge Commander. And there was some third-party voice recognition software that they recommended you use with it that I was using a free trial of, and you know, it was kind of cool because you could actually say, you know, like helm, set course, you know, warp 9, and you know, of course you'd have to say each of those like 3 times before it actually figured out what you were saying, even after a lengthy voice training session, because that was way back in like 2000 or whatever, so it was not very good. So it was a bad experience, and I would say I probably swore at it a bunch, and occasionally it would do something as a result of me swearing at it.
Did you swear at N-War at all?
Early on, because that one got drastically better as I played, to the point where, like, for the first few hours I had to, it would be like unit 1, attack, hostile 4. You know, you'd have to speak very slowly for it to understand. But towards the end, you know, after several more hours of playing, after a couple more hours anyway, wasn't that long, you could pretty much say unit 1 attack hostile 7, and it would do it. And you know, you'd have to repeat yourself sometimes, but not often enough to be frustrating.
Yeah, another Ubisoft game. I had a good time with, it's not really a main feature, but in Rainbow Six Vegas and Vegas 2, you could sort of issue commands to your squad mates, like regroup or stack up on a door, like go silent if you wanted them to switch, put on their silencers and things like that. It didn't maybe work like, I don't know, 60% of the time or something, but it was still a nice bit of immersion, like in that tactical experience where you're deconstructing situations, and it was fun. I like it. And I
hadn't done any voice recognition stuff in years. You know, the technology's never really been that good, and so oftentimes, you know, it's just an exercise in frustration. But I did try N-War, which I guess was, you know, the most recent one to really take a big stab at it. You know, it came with the headphones and the whole setup, which I thought was actually really, really well done. I liked how it, you know, made you, it kind of tested your voice to make sure you understood, you know, understood everything you were about to say. And so when I would give it commands, it actually had learned everything, learned all my speech patterns and everything really, really well. So there was none of that old frustrating stuff with old style voice technology where you'd say something the computer just did not recognize. It recognized everything really well. The problem that I found was that it's actually, it saves a certain kind of labor, but it actually replaces it with a new one. Instead of having to kind of move the mouse around or whatever, I just found it was a strange kind of chore to have to be talking to the computer, and I actually found it's a very self-conscious thing, you know, to be sitting at home on your own on a couch talking to a TV screen, and you start to wonder if you, you know, maybe you've gone a little bit mad. It always seems to work so well on Star Trek. You know, they happily talk to the computers and the turbo lifts, and maybe it's because in Star Trek the computer talks back to you, so you can actually have kind of a conversation with the computer. So it feels like it's a dialogue, but when I'm just talking at the TV screen, I'm seeing a response, but not a verbal response. It's, I don't know. There's something. Is it just me? There's something strangely self-conscious about it.
There definitely is. I mean, when I was playing, my fiance was a little bit irritated with me because, you know, it is. It's because you're saying the same thing over and over again. Basically, there's not a whole lot of variation in what you're saying, and it's not a conversational style thing. It's like in Star Trek, they'll be saying, "Hey, computer, I want you to do this, this, and this." Oh, and while you're at it, you know, turn on the lights, make me some tea, you know, make me a sandwich,
right.
And you know, it's telling it, they're telling it to do a bunch of different.
Yeah, and the computer will talk back. The computer will say, "Please specify what kind of sandwich."
Yeah,
and you'll say, "I'd like a roast beef sandwich," and the computer will say, "We don't have any roast beef." Well, no, but probably wouldn't say that. But
and that,
you know,
was
you
the
can have a conversation with the computer. Whereas, like you say, what you're doing at N-War is basically just saying, like, unit A, attack. unit B, move. And that's really all you're doing. And you're just very aware of the fact that you're on your own talking to nobody, and you feel quite weird about it.
Right. But I for one, hate when the Klingons steal my roast beef.
You know, when you're playing Rock Band and you don't know the lyrics, you can sort of just say things that sound like what they're supposed to sound like. Like,
oh, Wiedemann used to do that.
Yeah, and like make fun of the person sitting next to you to the beat or something.
he was playing I think it was a Karaoke Revolution game.
Yes.
At my house one time, and he was playing, and the song, it was the hardest song in the game. It was REM. It's the End of the World as We Know It.
God.
Which has that really, 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 the verses are really, really fast. Right. And there's a lot of words. And it's very easy to get tripped up. And so Greg would just start going, la, 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 la. And because the computer doesn't know the difference, it just hears the sounds but not the words. He was getting perfect scores. And, you know, we kept saying, well, you're cheating. And he's like, but he didn't really care. But I think in future games, I think that it's either already in like the most recent iterations of like the Guitar Hero Rock Band games, or it's something that they're talking about bringing in. I think it's maybe Lips. I think maybe it's the new Xbox karaoke game that can tell the difference, like whether or not you're actually saying the words. So if you try to just fudge it by making the sounds, it'll kick you out.
Right, because it's not doing actual speech recognition. It's just measuring like pitch and tone and all those other fancy words, or you know, music terms that I don't know entirely what they mean half the time. But yeah, it's not actually recognizing your words, which is a much more difficult task for a computer to do. All right, so why don't we move on to our playlists? Evan, what the hell have you been playing?
Well,
explain yourself.
I will attempt to. I've been playing some more Counter-Strike Source, and oh gosh, I'm going to be playing Xenoclash next week. That's something I'm looking forward to, but I'm hoping I can play and finish Fear 2, because I sort of only play the first couple chapters.
What were your impressions of the first few chapters?
I mean, really all I was hoping for was sort of a repackaging of what was so good in Fear 1, and that would be the ragdoll physics and the slow-mo gunplay and just those mechanics, those raw mechanics, and I didn't really get those.
Really? So, and it did do that.
I don't know. Maybe I just didn't get as good of an impression of it, but it didn't feel quite there to me. I don't know.
It was subtly different, I agree. It wasn't as satisfying as Fear, or at least as satisfying as most people remember Fear being. I went back and played a little bit of Fear, and the graphics in that don't hold up because they were going for a realism thing, and that by the way is something else that a illustrative art style will do better than a realistic one is hold up longer. It looks better longer, but. But it did feel like the action had just a little bit more weight to it. It felt a little bit more kinetic, like more impact to bullets and like the ragdoll in Fear 2 just feels a little bit off somehow. You can't really put your finger on it, but they don't fall down right. You're doing it wrong.
I don't know how I feel about those glowing enemies either.
Right, when you go into the slow motion, they light up. Like they're already moving really slow. Was it too hard to see them?
Yeah, exactly. Feels like easy mode. Anyway,
they don't count headshots very very much as doing very much damage, which I found kind of frustrating. But I understand why they do it, because in slow motion every shot can be a headshot, so it wouldn't be challenging at all. Andy, what are you playing?
I was on vacation since exactly like after like I got done with the podcast last Thursday. Got on a plane. Was on vacation in New York City. Got back last night, so I only played Peggle a little bit.
So Andy has been playing the excuses game.
Yeah,
so you've leveled up.
Or the real life GTA simulator.
Grand Theft Andy.
Josh, how about you?
I've been playing a bit of Battleforge, which has been really fun. Turning over those cards one by one when you buy the booster packs is so addicting. It's excellent.
They get the presentation of the cards mechanic. They get that right, huh?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's just like buying the pack. And you wait, and it turns over one by one. Because you have the button, if you're impatient, to just flip them all over instantly. But I like it when it goes real slow and you can kind of see half the card and you're trying to guess what it is.
It's like, oh baby, take it off.
Yeah.
Like, nice and slow.
This is getting really sensual really fast.
Yeah.
Just to explain real quick what that's about is you get units based on the cards you assemble a deck, and those are the units that you have available for the next mission, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like an RTS, just you're using the cards instead of like building from factories or whatever.
And you can actually buy new booster packs, just like in all the customizable card games. You buy packs of cards that have rare guys and rare units in them or whatever, right? I actually haven't tried it yet. I'm looking forward to that. I've got my copy right here.
Yeah, it's really easy to get in and just play with friends, which I'm really enjoying. I've been playing a lot of the two-player missions and the four-player missions. It's nice. You know, they have a little boss at the end, kind of like a dungeon if you're playing a typical MMO. It's really enjoyable.
Is it like Dawn of War 2 in that way?
I haven't played a lot of Dawn of War 2, to be honest. I've only played the first couple missions.
For shame.
I know, my disgrace. But I've also been playing WoW, and I got a giant T-Rex as my hunter pet, which I'm excited about.
And Gary, how about you?
I've been getting back into Peggle.
Yeah.
All things. Because it showed up on Xbox Live Arcade. And so now I can play it on, a 61-inch screen, which of course is no doubt how a game like Peggle is meant to be experienced. with 5.1 surround sound and high def resolution. Only now can Peggle be experienced in its purest form. So, no, that's been a lot of fun.
But you get achievements, which, oh, man.
It's made me, it's been long enough since I played it that I was able to go back and enjoy the game almost for the first time again. Like, I had completely forgotten, like, what the special bonuses were for each character, so it was kind of fun. Oh, this one splits the ball into two, and this one gives me the pyramid, and it was kind of fun all over again. And it made me kind of want to go, it made me curious, like, is Peggle Knights out yet? So I went to popcap.com and looked at Peggle Knights, but I was disappointed to realize $20 for Peggle Knights. I mean, I like casual games, but one of the appeal of casual games is they don't cost very much money. $20 seems like, I don't know if I'm just getting mean in my old age, but $20 seems like a lot of money for Peggle.
Well, how many Microsoft points was it on Xbox Live Arcade?
I would have to check, but it was probably, probably the equivalent of around $10.
Right.
Very few things. Like $15, I think, is as high as they've ever asked anyone to pay for. Actually, no, I think Grand Theft Auto 4, I think Lost in the Damned may have been $20.
I think Penny Arcade games.
Yeah, or Penny Arcade. There's a couple of real premium games, but I don't know. Did you guys ever review Peggle Knights? Is it worth getting? Should I drop $20 on it?
We did review it. It got docked for being very much more of the same. And not really like there was only like one new power and only a few levels designed for it, so it was a recommendation but not a strong recommendation.
Yeah. If you're into doing the challenge mode, there's a couple of challenge mode boards that are actually quite interesting compared to the other ones, and it's a lot harder so far. So I don't know, that takes a lot of time and commitment.
But Gary, I just don't think that the Xbox controller gives you the accuracy that you need for Peggle.
That's what I was asking, but it does. Yeah, I was asking the OXM guys. Yeah.
You can hold down one of the bumpers and you can get like the really incremental movement. It actually works very well on the, and it's a great game to kind of sit on the couch, with your, you talk about a casual game, when you're playing on your PC, unless you've got one of those home theater setups, you're usually sitting, in your office chair. But I think like on the big screen on your couch, that's kind of more the true definition of a casual game, because you can, kind of sit there flat on your back on the couch with a big, bowl of popcorn on your belly, crunching away and playing with your Xbox controller. That's a casual game to me.
That was me being facetious, by the way. I actually do think you could. Yeah.
It's often hard to tell.
I don't actually think it would be too hard to control Peggle with. I don't think it would be too hard to control Peggle with like the old like Pong controller which is a knob.
I was actually serious when
it's not completely wrong to say. I mean, yeah. Peggle, you do want to sometimes you want to get like a really kind of perfectly aimed shot, so you do have to hold down the button that gives you the very very incremental movement of the gun. So I found myself doing that on some of the tougher levels.
So as for myself, I've just been playing a bunch of Company of Heroes Tales of Valor. I was playing a bunch of multiplayer with Josh, and I have a fun little thing that I do where I name every game just like a little insult to Josh, like Josh smells bad, or Or what were some highlights, Josh?
Oh man, there are so many. They haunt me in my nightmares.
But I just figure that that by him joining that game, he is agreeing to that statement. That's the implication. I've just started playing The Sims 3 for review, so that's taking up some time. I'll cover that more when I can. What else have I been playing? Oh, you know what? Speaking of big screens, I just saw a press release from Westinghouse that we got the other day. A 42-inch screen for $700.
That's actually pretty good. I bought myself a little 32-inch Westinghouse recently, and I really like it. It seems like a good brand.
Yeah, I've been using my Westinghouse 42-inch screen that I got off of Woot.com. Actually, it's a 1080p. I got it almost exactly 2 years ago, and it was a little over $1,000 when I got it. And I love the hell out of that thing. I play all my games on it. And the only problem that I've had with it lately is that there seems to be a little bit more susceptible to image persistence, because on an LCD there's no actual burn in. That's what you call it on a plasma TV is burn in. On an LCD there's still a shadow behind like of the colors don't change quite like they should be. There's a shadow of an image. And actually, I've got some on my work screen that's a little bit more ingrained in it. I've got to figure out a way to get rid of that. But it seems a little bit more susceptible to that now than it was a year ago. Like I was playing a bunch of GTA 4 a couple weeks ago, and there's the little circular map in the bottom left hand corner of the screen. After I quit out of the game, I would still see that circle. Like if I moved an image over it, I could see the outline of that circle. And like, you know, things that sit on your screen for a while, you'd see, it goes away. So it's certainly not permanent. You can speed it up just by blanking out the screen, putting up a white document or something and, leaving it for a few minutes, it'll go away, but it's a little bit annoying. But this is a 2 year old model, so maybe the new ones don't have that problem. But yeah, I don't think I can ever go back to just a tiny monitor at home. All right, so that'll just about do it for us this week. Thank you all for joining us. If you want to send in some questions, we will happily take them next week. The address to email your MP3s to is pcgamerpodcast@gmail.com. The number I can never remember, so I make Andy repeat it every time.
1-877-404-1337, extension 724 for PC Gamer, BCG.
Yeah, you were awfully ready with that. Did you know I was going to do that, Andy?
No, I just know it.
You haven't gotten used to me just throwing that to you every time?
You know, but you don't host every single time, so.
That's true.
And actually, if I could throw some more numbers at people, if you want to play on the PC Gamer and Max PC TF2 server, I'll give you the IP. I'll throw it in the comments thread as well, but it is 66.151.138.34:27015. We're on there almost every night, Pacific time, and have a lot of fun, so come join us.
And if you would like to subscribe to the magazine, please do. You just go to pcgamer.com for that. So, yeah, that'll do it for us. We'll see you all next week. I'm Dan Stapleton. We've got Evan Lottie, Josh Augustine, Andy Bauman, and Gary Witta saying see you next week.
How's New York, dude?
Oh, you know, chilling.
New York-y.
Yeah, it was cool. There's a sweet restaurant called Ninja that I always go to. Where
oh, yeah?
What?
It's like ninja-themed, you know? It's like medieval times, feudal times.
That's really cool.
It's pretty sweet, and it's just funny, because the ninjas like are kind of self-aware and like, like self-deprecating that they have to dress up like ninjas. So it's always a good time.
That's excellent.
And the food is like expensive and good. So.
Is it served on like shurikens or katana blades?
They do have like a ninja star, like thing that they like do. It's pretty cool.
Nice.